Welcome to Fire on the Prairie. Today we bring you an argument for withdrawal from Iraq, an Iranian's perspective on the situation in Iran, and comments from a man who lost his son in the War on Terror.
Fire on the Prairie is the monthly radio show sponsored by In These Times magazine. I am Emily Udell.
And I'm Aaron Sarver. On this episode, I talk to Kaveh Ehsani. Ehsani writes about current events in Iran and is an editor for the journal Middle East Report.
The U.S. basically wants capitulation. They're not interested in negotiating as equals, and that's what the Iranian leadership wants, whereas what the Bush administration wants is, you know, one-sided capitulation by the Iranian regime, which is never going to happen.
We also have an interview with Anthony Arno, author of the new book, The Logic of Withdrawal.
Finally, you'll hear a commentary by Juan Torres. Torres is a member of Gold Star Families for Peace.
First up, an interview with Anthony Arno. Anthony Arno is author of the recently published book, The Logic of Withdrawal. The following discussion was part of an event hosted by In These Times in Chicago. Chicago Sun-Times columnist and In These Times senior editor Laura Washington interviewed Arno after a brief talk by historian Studs Terkel.
The title of this book has an interesting origin. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. Yeah, like Studs, I like to plagiarize. I plagiarized this title from Howard Zinn, who's probably my favorite plagiary. In 1967, Howard Zinn wrote a book called Vietnam, The Logic of Withdrawal. And that book argued that the only sensible course that the United States could take was immediate, unconditional withdrawal. And that was in 1967. And then you think how many more years that war went on and how many more people died. And to this day, people in this country, people in Vietnam, still suffering the consequences of that, of the continuation of that war. And it wasn't just that it continued, but it was expanded. Even after, you know, Howard laid out this powerful case, even after the Tet Offensive in 1968, even after it was clear that the United States was losing in Vietnam, that the people of Vietnam did not want the United States there, they expanded the war into Laos, into Cambodia. Millions of people died. And in 2002, I was fortunate enough to, at South End Press, republish a lot of books by Howard that had gone out of print, and that was one of them. And I reread the book, and then when this most recent phase of the U.S. war on Iraq, which has gone through many phases, but this most recent phase, when the invasion took place in 2003, I went back and looked at it again, and I was struck by how many of the arguments Howard was making were the same arguments we were having to make again today in regard to Iraq. And like Studs said, there's a history that's been forgotten and that we need to bring back to people, a history of what the U.S. has done in the world and also a history of how people have resisted it.
You bring up history, and of course you are a student of history, and Studs is definitely the ultimate student of history. And one of the things he said to me when I interviewed him a few weeks ago for In These Times was, we talked about the war, and he said part of the problem is that we forget our history. The way you put it is we're suffering from a national Alzheimer's disease when it comes to our history. Talk a little bit about what are the things we're forgetting that would be applicable and instrumental as we discuss this war.
Well, first of all, I think we have to start with where the amnesia comes from, that it's systematically encouraged, that, you know, our school textbooks, our national establishment media, the corporate media outlets deny that history, don't tell that history, or they tell a completely false version of our history. And so when George Bush says we're bringing democracy to Iraq, or we're bringing civilization to Iraq, or we're stopping civil war from breaking out there, people don't necessarily know the whole history of when the United States has claimed to be bringing democracy to other people or claimed to be preventing civil war in other countries. But if you knew a little bit about that history, for example, go back to the Philippines. George Bush actually in 2003 cited the occupation of the Philippines as a model for the occupation of Iraq. But go back and look at the occupation of the Philippines, and in the name of democracy, what the United States did to the Philippines people, the torture, the massacres, the denial of democracy to those people who remained under occupation for decades and then had a dictatorship supported by the United States that cruelly treated the population. If you know some of that history, if you've read Studs, if you've read Howard Zinn, if you've read the genuine history of this country, then you have a lot more skepticism when politicians stand before you and say, we're bringing democracy to Iraq, that's why we're there.
You talk, interestingly enough, about terminology in the book, and phrases and terms that are used not only in this war but have been used in history to spin, so to speak, American imperialism and American empire building. Three that I made notes of was the concept of foreign fighters and coming into Iraq. Terrorism and who are the terrorists.
Yep.
The Arab mind, that was one that seemed especially insidious to me. Can you talk about those specific phrases and what impact they have and how they're being used?
Foreign fighters, I mean, yeah, this really Orwell could say a lot about. But the idea that the United States sends 140,000 soldiers into a country knowing, none of them knowing Arabic, you know, a handful, knowing nothing about Arab culture. I was speaking on a panel with a vet earlier this week, and he said we had 30 minutes of sensitivity training before we went into Iraq. 30 minutes. And then you say, but the problem is that we're being resisted by foreign fighters, and we have to make sure that there's no foreign meddling in Iraq in reference to Iran, which is Iraq's neighbor. That's foreign meddling. But 140,000 troops plus all the other international troops that have been brought in, they're not foreign fighters. And of course, this idea of foreign fighters, I mean, is absurd at another level, which is that they want to make it seem as if anyone who's resisting the occupation is somehow was sent into the country from outside to fight. But even their own studies now show the overwhelming majority of people are Iraqis who are spontaneously resisting and resent the occupation.
Now, you had a great stat in there about the number of people who actually had foreign passport. They rounded up over a period of time, and it was some minuscule percentage.
4%.
Yeah.
And for an Iraqi to have a foreign passport is not that hard to do, because a lot of Iraqis were working in other countries as exiles and under the dictatorship, and so may have come back but had different paperwork. Mm-hmm. And that's the reporting of the U.S. military itself. So they have every interest in exaggerating the number of people that they've rounded up, and they only really came up with 4%. And then you come to terrorists. The whole war in Iraq is being sold as a war on terrorism. Well, first of all, Iraq was not in any way a threat to the United States, was not sponsoring terrorism, was not connected to 9/11. But secondly, the bigger issue is that the United States is using state terrorism against the people of Iraq. And the largest terrorists in Iraq today are the people who are using the force of an occupying army to suppress the people who don't want them there. And so it seems to me we have to be, you know, redefine that term and not fall into the trap of saying that there's somehow an otherwise legitimate war on terrorism. It's just that Iraq is a distraction from it. Iraq is a central part of a whole ideological assault, partly an assault on Islam, partly an assault on Muslims in this country, immigrants as well, an attack on civil liberties. But it's a whole framework of trying to sell endless war. Mm-hmm. You know, Rumsfeld talks about there might be 50 or 60 countries that we're targeting. George Bush saying, this occupation of Iraq, it's not up for me to say when it'll end, it'll be the next administration. So they're trying to sell a series of interventions through this framework. And then another component of that, and a very racist component, is this idea that the Arab mind, as it's termed in so-called academic scholarly literature, but in literature that's being read by the military and internally distributed to soldiers in some cases, the Arab mind only understands violence. The Arab mind only understands force. And selling a whole set of racist ideas about the people who you are occupying and what you have to do in order to subjugate them.
You made a connection to this concept of the Arab mind in terms of what was happening at Abu Ghraib and in terms of torture. Talk about that. So there was a rationale that actually is being inculcated into the training of soldiers about violence and relating that to the subjugation.
Absolutely. There was a conscious attempt to use an idea of how you sexually humiliate Arab men in order to control and dominate them. And so when they say, oh, Abu Ghraib, we were shocked. When they say, it was just a couple of bad apples. When they say we had no idea this was happening, this had nothing to do with their training, with what they were authorized to do, it's completely untrue. This is a logical outcome of a whole series of directives that have been given to soldiers about how to treat prisoners, how to treat Iraqis, and it flows from the logic of occupation, which does rely on that dehumanization of the quote-unquote enemy. So I think Abu Ghraib, and it's not just Abu Ghraib, we have to remember, it's other torture facilities in Iraq, it's other detention centers in Iraq, it's just, you know, part of a much bigger picture. And today, in Iraq, there are still 14,000 Iraqis in detention. 50 to 60,000 have gone through the detention facilities. And many of the people who are being detained have been held more than 2 years, never having any trial, any due process, any evidence presented against them, any way of contesting their claims. In many cases, their families don't even know where they are. You have families going around from detention center to detention center trying to find their loved ones.
Some of those people that were out demonstrating and some of those people who weren't sure where they stood are now saying, you know, look, I had my doubts. I thought this was the wrong move, but we're here now. We're invested. We have to see this through. It's not just the Bush administration saying it. It's well-meaning people who are very much about peace. Yeah. What's your response to that argument?
Look, I mean, that's why I wrote this book, because, you know, the logic of withdrawal is not that the Bush administration is going to read this book and feel, you know, oh, okay, now, you know, we see the logic with the error in our ways. Well, I mean,
that would mean the Bush would have to read eight books
exactly.
to get to this book. Yeah.
So it's not about that. The logic is that I hope that a lot of those people who did oppose the war when it first began, but now have been persuaded by various arguments about there might be civil war if we leave, the consequences might be worse if we leave, don't we have an obligation to the Iraqi people, really well-meaning people, those are the people who I think can hear the logic of the argument I'm making. And so I think we have to be very patient with those people and go through their questions and their concerns. And the basic case I'm making is that the longer the United States stays in Iraq, the worse it will get. The longer the United States stays in Iraq, the greater the chance of civil war. The longer the United States stays in Iraq, the more destabilizing it is globally in terms of increasing the chance of nuclear conflict and war with the kinds of consequences that Studs was talking about earlier. So then, you know, we can get into the specifics of those arguments, but I think we can also just look back at the last 3 years of occupation. They keep saying it's going to get better, it's going to get better, it's going to get, you know, they've had a whole series of markers. Once we capture Saddam Hussein, okay, no, that didn't work. We don't want to have elections, but once we have elections. And then, okay, well, once we have a constitution, and then once we have a stable political, you know, once we train all these benchmarks, but if you just like block it off in 6 month markers, each 6 months, it's worse. Mm-hmm. So we've got a lot of evidence of how things are getting worse as a result of the occupation, and I think that we can predict with a high degree of certainty that it'll only continue to get worse unless we can compel the United States to withdraw.
You just heard an interview by journalist Laura Washington with writer Anthony Arnov. Arnov's new book is The Logic of Withdrawal.
In July 2004, Juan Torres lost his son, an Army specialist who was stationed in Afghanistan. Since his son's death, Torres has been traveling around the country speaking out against war. He is a member of Gold Star Families for Peace. What follows is an excerpt of a speech Torres gave in Chicago.
My son is dying inside the base of Bagram, Afghanistan. We have many proof of what really happened to my son, but you know the military. Like the same, he's dying in the same area when the Pat Tillman, the football player. You know how long they took my son investigation? 2 hours. You know why? They say they don't have a personal, and they cost a lot of money. But May 7, I fly to Afghanistan for 3 weeks. We're going to finish my son's documentary. I know everybody say, Juan, be careful, it's very dangerous. But I had to go and finish my job because I want to see what really happened to my son. We have all proof, Lara, real proof, but military, they don't want to open any case. They want to cover up everything. In Europe, they give me a lot of opportunities, especially in Spain, because I speak Spanish, you know, this is very easy for me. But everybody say, what happened with American people? And saying, sorry, the problem is the media. The media, they don't help. But everybody is saying the same. We got before you have a big problem about the Vietnam War. And the same group of people say, why do you live in this country? Why? You are a criminal too. No, I'm not criminal. People, sometimes they attack you because if you have an American passport, you are in trouble. Why? We need to change the mentality. We need working for peace. We have 290 million people in this country. But how many people is coming? If you see any kind of rally, you see the immigrant rally, 500,000-600,000 people out in the street. Wow, beautiful. On the last minute, you see Senator Durbin, I hear. But I talked to Durbin the other day. So, Mr. Durbin, you want to be coming to a rally? Yes, Mr. Torrey, you know, I support the immigrant, you know, but I don't say the rally, the immigrant. I say the anti-war rally. Senator and Mr. Torres, but we have to finish the job. We're going to finish the mission. What kind of mission? What kind of job? How many more kids die? How many more Iraqi people die? You don't care because you don't have nobody in this war, you know. The President Bush, all the congressmen, they don't have any kids in this war. We need to do something about the military in the school. We got a solution. I talked to a couple of people, but nobody do anything because we need to involve the mother. It's very important. We got the experience in Argentina, the mother of the Plaza de Mayo. It's a very example, easy. If you have a school, 2,000 students, how many mothers in school? 2,000. How you put 2-3 mothers outside the school, like soldiers, when they come in, the recruit is coming, say, get out. We pay the taxes for education. We don't pay the taxes for educated kids to kill. It's very simple. And I say, thank you for giving me opportunity. I'm sorry, my English is terrible, you know, but maybe you understand 50%. Thank you.
You just heard an excerpt of a speech given by Juan Torres. You're listening to Fire on the Prairie. To hear past shows, visit fireontheprairie.com.
Kaveh Issani is a researcher at the University of Illinois Chicago and an editor for the journal Middle East Report. Aaron Sarver recently interviewed Issani about the rise to power of Iran's president, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, and current relations between Tehran and Washington.
In an article recently posted on opendemocracy.org, you wrote, quote, "He was not elected on a platform favoring an ideological confrontation with the West, but rather on promises to fight corruption and improve the lot of unemployed and impoverished Iranians," end quote. You're referring to the president of Iran, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. What were the internal dynamics of the campaign that were missed by the Western press?
When Ahmadinejad was elected in the second round of the presidential elections, what was really highlighted was his radical and ideological credentials rather than what really attracted a lot of poor and ordinary Iranians to vote for him in the second round of the elections. Now, the first round of the elections were, by all accounts, you know, ridden with a lot of controversy and perhaps rigging and fraud. There was a whole voting machine of conservative rank and file that basically rallied behind him and with a lot of fraud managed to kind of put him through the second round against Rafsanjani, and I think a lot of people voted against Rafsanjani rather than for Ahmadinejad. You know, he just basically came across as an ordinary, non-corrupt, non-clerical candidate who all he was trying to do was to better the lot of the ordinary people.
One of his campaign promises was to, quote, "put the petroleum income on people's tables." It seems like average Iranians were responding to his populist economic appeal.
That's true. The real picture is a lot more complicated. The perception was that the country's economy is really monopolized by the political class and tremendous corruption at the top, and nothing is trickling down toward ordinary people, and that's what Ahmadinejad appealed to with really simplistic slogans such as, you know, distributing the oil wealth. You know, now Iran's GDP is something around $300 billion. Iran's oil revenues annually are at best, you know, around $20, $30 billion. There's no comparison between the size of the economy and what the oil income actually is. But what, you know, symbolically Ahmadinejad was pointing to was the fact that there is wealth produced. It's become quite conspicuous, but ordinary people are not really benefiting from it.
To what extent has President Ahmadinejad been able to enact his domestic policy?
None at all. At least, like, with creating employment and cutting back corruption, he's been completely unsuccessful. The parliament rejected the budget because it really relied on projected increases in oil revenue, while the country has been trying to wean itself from oil revenues for the past, you know, 8-10 years. If Ahmadinejad wanted to actually improve the economy, it's very clear what he had to do. Iran's economy is being controlled by a lot of mafias, which really benefits from the embargo that's been imposed on the country for the past 20 years by the United States. These mafias are rooted in the military and security apparatus. They import, you know, they have monopolies over importing, often illegally, a lot of commodity goods. They choke Iran's economy. They really control a lot of the investment, both foreign and domestic. What Ahmadinejad needed to do was to really go after these monopolies and make the economy transparent. He did not do this because, you know, these monopolies are really the people that support him. People in the military and the security apparatus are the people who really kind of assured his ascendance to power in the first place.
The president is portrayed as a very conservative figure. Has there been a change in the lives of average Iranians under his tenure?
One of the things that really appealed to the public in the election process was his major election film, where, you know, at one point he's asked, if you come to power, are you going to try to restrict women and impose even stricter kind of public dress code on women? His reply was, do you seriously think me stupid enough to believe that a couple of strands of hair showing under a woman's scarf is really what is wrong with this society? That's not our problem. Our problem is corruption and unemployment. What the culture ministry has been doing has been tightening the rein on publishers, on the press, on the film industry, and the cultural sphere in general. So yes, we do see increasing restrictions socially toward the conservatism. But Ahmadinejad himself is not necessarily in favor of this. It's just that his supporters are, and he needs those supporters. Therefore, he's going to pay lip service.
There's been a lot of debate surrounding President Ahmadinejad's comments about the Holocaust. Do his comments serve some internal or external political purpose?
Yes, they do, I think. This is a little bit speculative on my part. But I think if you look at the history of the post-revolution, I think at every juncture where there had been talks or even hints of serious rapprochement between Iran and the United States, segments of the security apparatus and the power structure, especially the military power structure in Iran, sabotaged this rapprochement quite blatantly. This has happened numerous times. And I think, you know, what Ahmadinejad did with his comments about Holocaust was along the same lines. I mean, he probably sensed that there was a rapprochement taking place at the time in the fall between Larijani, who was the chief negotiator of the Iranian atomic negotiation team, with the Americans and the Europeans. I mean, that's when the first idea of Iran negotiating directly with the U.S. over Iraq was floated by Zalmi Khalilzad, who's U.S. as a Iraqi ambassador. And I think in some ways it can be speculated that, you know, the Ahmadinejad was really voicing concerns of the, you know, arch-conservative elements within the Iranian power structure to scuttle these talks and not have them unless it was on their terms.
You've written that prominent voices in Tehran that are outside of the power structure are calling for negotiations with Washington, and that discreetly, even hardliners like Ayatollah Ali Khamenei are signaling that they're open to negotiations. Why haven't we seen more progress towards talks?
Because Washington refuses to do this, point blank. Iran sent a very clear signal in 2002 and then in 2003. Financial Times has written extensively about this. It's well documented, and it's public knowledge now that, you know, Iranians have even sent negotiation teams to negotiate with the U.S. And Khamenei, on March 22nd, explicitly endorsed discussions with the U.S. In Iraq. What he also said was that we are not going to gain anything by negotiating with the U.S. because the U.S. basically wants capitulation. They're not interested in negotiating as equals, and that's what the Iranian leadership wants, whereas what the Bush administration wants is, you know, one-sided capitulation by the Iranian regime, which is never going to happen. The Iranians have sent numerous and unmistakable signals that what they want is starting toward normalizing relations, but on equal terms. They don't want to be a venue where the U.S. basically interrogates Iran about its bad behavior in the past. You know, what they want is to have everything on the table and get security assurances and normalize relations.
How are deteriorating conditions in Iraq affecting negotiations or lack thereof?
The main thing that's preventing Iraq from descending into absolute chaos has been Iranian support, self-interested support, for urging the Shia to stay the course and not retaliate against primarily Sunni provocations. I think the U.S. and Iran's agenda, ironically, are quite similar in Iraq. They both want some stability. So Iran, I think, has been the big gainer, you know, in the Iraqi situation. But at the same time, I think U.S. is quite uneasy about Iran's influence, and it does not want to recognize it. Part of the flexing of the muscles by the U.S. is to basically show the Iraqi Shia they can't count on Iranian support, because U.S. is going to bloody Iran's nose and put it, you know, cut it down to size and put Iran in its place. And the only allies in the long run that the Shia can hope to have, not Iran, but it's the U.S. So therefore, the Shia in Iraq should really reduce their demands and really kind of rely on the U.S. and not play this game of partial reliance on U.S. and partial reliance on Iran, but basically just kind of turn a cold shoulder to Iranians. I don't think the geopolitics of the region will allow this. This is the Middle East, so everybody is aware that they don't have absolute power, that they need allies, and they will go on playing this game of cat and mouse.
You just heard an interview with Kaveh Ehsani, an editor for Middle East Report and a researcher at the University of Illinois, Chicago.
Thanks for tuning in to this month's edition of Fire on the Prairie. Visit us online at fireontheprairie.com to hear past shows and sign up for our podcast.
Fire on the Prairie is produced by Aaron Sarver and Emily Udell in Chicago. This show is sponsored by In These Times magazine. Visit In These Times on the web at inthesetimes.com.
Please join us again next month for Fire on the Prairie. Thank you.